If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Notes from a Native Daughter. I am Sol Daniela. This is episode 6 with guest Leticia Peguero, Executive Director for the Andrews Family Fund.
Here we have Leticia Peguero, my guest for episode 6 for Notes from a Native Daughter. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm excited.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to say, let everybody know that you are an accomplished a woman leader. She is. This is all true. She has a very interesting and respectable job, and she'll explain that better than I. And she works at the intersection of what I find really fascinating, which is culture and society and social justice. And I find that fascinating, and she's a pro. And we're going to navigate a little bit through her career. And we can start from now, we can work our way back, sure. Or it doesn't have to be chronologically. But I think there's real power in what you do and what you've been doing for so many years. And I feel compelled to sort of get to know more of why mm-hmm. and what fuels you mm-hmm. To where you are today, which is amazing. You're also a dancer, and I share that mm-hmm. common ground with you. I was a dancer for so many years, mm-hmm. and so I think it's fascinating. And it doesn't surprise me at all that you are a dancer and so mm-hmm. disciplined, but I'm doing something like this. It mm-hmm. just makes total sense. So maybe talk about that mm-hmm. arc, like from mm-hmm. dancing to executive director.
Yeah, yeah. So,
let's see how it goes.
Okay. So that's interesting. You know, I've always danced since I was a little kid. And I tell people, which I think is completely true, that my first love, the first thing that I ever loved was dance. How that sort of happened, I'm not really sure. I think it was just what it was, right? I used to, hop around the house as a little kid. I used to put on shows for my mother and for my grandmother, you know, the two women that I grew up with. And I started to take class when I was pretty young, probably around 5. But you know, as the daughter of a working class, family, you know, I think that, and I would actually say working poor, right? Like working poor in the United States, It impacts you in ways that I think just now, when you look back, you start to see kind of how practical I was. Even as a teenager, I was first generation to go to college in my family, and I remember I auditioned for a BFA program, but I don't know, there was something about being poor as a kid that just said to me, you can't do this art thing. And so I always thought I'd be a teacher. You know, that sort of made sense to me. But the idea of spending, you know, the little bit of money that I had to pursue full-time dancing, there was just something about it that seemed really impractical to me. And so I feel like my life has been this very, I've never been able to leave the dancing behind very far. And so I've always danced kind of on the side. I've always taken classes. I've performed a ton while I did everything else, right? While I worked with young people, while I worked at Planned Parenthood, while I did, you know, my sort of social justice work. And the arts became, you know, when I was younger, I would say it was the thing I did on the side. Now, I think, I don't know, it just seems like a seamless part of my life. Like, dancing and the arts and thinking about how arts plays itself out in the work that I do now, has somehow become really seamless in a way that I think when I was younger, I compartmentalized it more, like dancing and the arts happens at this time. And then, you know, working happens here and this is what pays the bills. And now it seems in a really interesting way. It's much less, it doesn't happen in compartments that way. You know what I mean? Yeah.
They're integrated ideas in your being, and so you can move around.
Yeah, come in and out in ways that I, in a way that I think I just maybe didn't have the vocabulary for when I was 23 or 22, you know. Add 20 years of living to that, and that changes, you know.
Tears of joy, tears of joy, sister.
The 10,000 joys and sorrows, all of it together.
Right. Wow. Mm-hmm. So now what do you do at
Yeah, the AFF.
Yeah.
So now I'm the past 3.5 years, I've been the executive director of a social justice philanthropy. And I got into philanthropy by accident. You know, I was an organizer and I worked in community. You know, my idea was always that I needed to be in the front lines doing work with you know, people that that are from sort of where I am. But I always feel like, you know, I have a little bit of privilege, right? I've been able to go to college, and so then how do you give that back? And so that was always my idea, right? That I'm going to work at, I've worked at places like The Door and Planned Parenthood, you know, working with young people. And then I, you know, applied for a graduate program, an MPA program through a fellowship called the National Urban Fellows. And the way that the fellowship worked was that you got your master's degree, they paid for it, but then you had to do this, what they call the mentorship somewhere. And you had to sort of compete with your cohort. And I competed and I got my mentorship at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And which is one of the biggest foundations in the country that's dedicated specifically to health and healthcare. And I worked there for about a year. I did it with my wonderful mentor, this woman, Deborah Perez, said to me, come, you know, you'd be great. And I remember walking in and thinking, oh, Lord, like, this is awful. It was, like, really quiet. And I was used to being in places with young people and a lot of activity and a lot of, and this was like a mausoleum. Sorry, RWJF friends. But they all know that I feel that way. But it was the beginning of the rest of my life. It really changed what I knew about the nonprofit sector, how I knew what I knew. And then something that Deborah said to me and continues to say to me is that philanthropy is a really white world. It's a world that doesn't have a lot of people of color in it, even though a good portion of their money is going to communities of color, or at least to try to think about the issues, right, that African-American and Latino communities are facing across the country. And there's no way in. It's not very clear, like, how does one get into professional philanthropy? And, you know, the whole time I was working with her, I kept telling her, I just want to go back to doing the work that I know how to do, you know, working on the front line. And she said to me, well, I just think it's really important for you to think about the power that you, as a woman of color, as someone who's first generation here, whose family comes from Puerto Rico, whose English was your second language, what does it mean for you to be in this place where you're deciding where money goes? And that was sort of my trajectory into philanthropy. And I worked there for quite some years. And then 3.5 years ago, I started to work at the Andrus Family Fund as the executive director. And it's been an interesting ride. It's philanthropy is sort of a very strange industry. There are not a lot of people of color. We're a social justice funder. So I feel really privileged that I get to talk race and equity and gender all day long. It's what I do. And there's something for me that feels really privileged about that. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And what are some of the things that are not obvious in the landscape, in the narrative of news, mm-hmm. that you think is a red flag, like just burn and wait and...
You know, that's a great question. So every now and then I say, you know, I sound like a broken record, right? When I go to these, I go to meetings all the time, and I am forever saying, so I'll say two things. One may be a little bit politically incorrect, but I'm going to say it anyways. So one is that, you know, I think there's some really interesting sort of black holes of conversation within the Latino community in philanthropy, right? Because I'll speak what I know, but I imagine that this is the same in other parts as well, where we're not really having great conversations about race, the way that it plays out in our own community. And as someone who identifies right as Afro-Latina, I feel that it's really important for us to talk about it, right? That that it is just a, sort of a, there's a little bit of a vacuum in terms of like how we talk about blackness in our community, or we don't, right? The lack of conversation.
That's right.
Right. And so in the philanthropic sector, I've been sort of trying to navigate that and thinking through, you know, this is, you know, it's a huge sector with lots of money, and how do we begin to have conversations that are bigger and broader for the Latino community than just immigration? I mean, immigration is really important, but there's also like social justice issues and issues of race that are really important for the Latino community as well. And how do we begin to navigate that and really have honest conversations about what does it mean for us as a people, as a people that will be the majority, right? Along with other, right, brown and black folks. So I think to me that's really key. And how we navigate that, I think, will determine, right, our ability to build coalitions in the future. And I think it's a social justice issue. And I think it's really, really, it's sort of under the radar, right? Like, folks don't really talk about it. That, and then, you know, the other thing that I spend a lot of time thinking about, frankly, is, like, we have all of these young people, right, between the ages of 16 and 24, black and brown, you know, Puerto Rican, Dominican, African American, that are not connected to school and work. And who will they be in the future? In this super future that I think is not necessarily welcoming to them and doesn't have jobs for them, right? The way that our future is
structured.
Yeah, the way the future of work, right? So... So, like, I could talk about that forever, but I spend a whole lot of time thinking about those two things. I think it's going to be really, for the communities that I care about, I think the challenges are going to be great. And what to do about it, I'm not sure. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about this. I have no answers, but I definitely think we're behind the curve. And
behind who is we behind the curve?
I think communities of color. I mean, I think whole I think people who lack power, which in the United States tends to be white, brown, and black folk.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah. I think we are, like for anything else, we will catch up when it's a little bit late. You know, and the economy has begun to shift. And I think we see, you know, when people talk about, you know, some of the sort of political things that folks are talking about right now, right? Some of what, how have people garnered around Trump or whatever? I think we begin to see some of the displacement that, right, that the last 40 years has left us with. And I think, like always happens, communities of color will suffer more. Right, and so what the answers are, I'm not sure.
What are the things that you have done at Andrews that really makes you proud, or it's a passion project within the organization?
So So, you know, I get to talk to a lot of really awesome people doing really great work across the country. I think it keeps me super, I can get very emotional about it, you know, and so I get to meet amazing advocates on the ground and people who are, you know, a young brother who spent from 14 to 27 in prison and is now dedicating his life, right, to ending adult sentencing for juvenile young people. And I think, yeah, when I sit and I talk with him or I sit and I talk to others like him, it just reminds me every day, right, why having someone on the inside to represent his work is really important. Yeah, this group in California that we fund that are teaching young people that are gang involved about restorative justice, right? Like, how do you heal your community? How do you go back to the teachings, really, right, of our ancestors? How do you take young people that are wounded by violence and recreate them, right, from the inside out? And I think there's something really special to sitting and being in community, folks that do this work every day, which is, you know, what I thought I would be doing.
What kind of things do they do?
Yeah, so they do the what we call restorative justice practices. So this idea that that instead of retaliating against, let's say, a gang member from another gang, right, who hurt you. And we're talking about pretty serious crimes, right, felony level, some young people getting shot and stabbed. So instead of retaliating, actually sitting in community together and holding each other accountable, right? And so there's all these practices that go along with it. So you would get people that you trust to be in the circle with you, and you would come up with things that you could do to pay, that this person can do to pay you back that doesn't involve violence. And so it might mean this person has to, I'm making some of this stuff up, but, you know, has to, I don't know, go volunteer and go work with young people in the community. And there's a bunch of these programs across the country in schools and out of school. And there's actually one here in New York that's doing it in collaboration with the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office for a felony level. So, you know, young people that get arrested for, you know, battery and assault. And as long as the harmed party, right, the person that's on the receiving end of the violence agrees, they can go into this program. That does not then mean there's yet one more person in prison. So, you know, there, for me, there's incredible power in funding those programs, right, that are looking for alternative ways to heal our communities from what I believe is state-enforced policies, right, that have gotten us, right, yeah, to marginalize, to incarcerate, mm-hmm. To decimate, mm-hmm. Communities of color. Like, this didn't happen, in my opinion, by accident. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We didn't wake up one morning. If we look at Puerto Rico, what's happening in Puerto Rico, it didn't wake up one morning and all of a sudden, right, Puerto Rico is in the situation that it's in. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, years and years and decades of
corruption in the making.
Exactly, right? And I think, you know, how do we each play a little role in trying to heal the little corners, right, little pockets of community that we can. So those are some of the things that I think inspire me in this work.
And what about your work with the Posse Foundation?
Ah, yeah.
That's important.
Yeah. Yeah, I worked at Posse, for a relatively short amount of time. But, you know, Posse is a really interesting organization, which I think reminds me a little bit of my trajectory. So, you know, they're looking for young people and to their intensities right now across the country. But young people that traditionally would not get into to some of the tier one colleges, right? And that can be because they are they don't score well, right, in the traditional tests or whatever, right? They've gone to schools that haven't prepared them. And so their belief is that there are other ways to make sure that different intelligences make their way through. Mm-hmm. And so they have a much very different screening mechanism that doesn't necessarily just involve the testing, which we know is not biased, right? We know that it isn't, that there's bias, right, in the test. And so I worked with them for a little bit and helped them replicate their program in Houston and worked with the New Orleans office. Yeah, was able to think through during my time there what does it mean, right, for young people that have been historically marginalized to make their way through the university system, and what does it take? Because getting in is just part of the equation, right? Making your way through it is a whole other.
How did you make through it? You were the first person.
Yeah, sometimes it's a little bit of a mystery to me. I mean, I think it was really challenging. I had a very hard time in undergrad. I was part of the Higher Education Opportunity Program, which is one is for kids who are poor, or don't have the economic resources. And then, two is also for, you know, for kids who might need a little bit more help. And so I did like a summer program before I got into school. And I think for me, the hardest thing was academics were hard, but the harder thing was actually the culture. It was really interesting to be around wealthy, even wealthy Puerto Ricans, frankly. Like, actually, to be completely honest, I had no idea that there were wealthy Puerto Ricans until I was 18, which is such a, you know, when I think back to it, I think, like, how did I not know that, right? But it was really interesting. So Fordham, which is where I went, because it's a Jesuit school, right? There's a lot of Puerto Ricans from the island that make their way over that are wealthy. And I remember being actually in awe of it. Like, who are these people? Because all the Puerto Ricans I know are people from here, or, you know, people that come to visit but their families are living in the neighborhoods that I grew up in. So I remember just being in awe of it. Like, oh my goodness, how did I not know that there was this whole other group of people,
yes,
in the island where, you know, my mother was born and we would go to visit family that are living very similarly to the way that people live here. It was just, you know, one of those naive moments, right? Where you're like, wow, there's this whole other world out there.
There's a whole other world out there.
That you have no idea. You know, when you're, you know, I grew up in Sunset Park and I grew up in a very different world. And so it was, you know, I think to me that was really powerful. Those cultural lessons were really powerful for me in undergrad, I think, in some really good ways, and then in some really ways that are not so, right, that were much more hard, right? So, yeah.
And where is your family now?
So most of my family's here. They're in not in the Bronx, in Brooklyn, and I have aunt that lives in Atlanta now. You know, most people are here. I mean, some of my mother's cousins are still in PR, but for the most part, people are here. Very New York heavy, New York based.
And you came to the Bronx because you were fleeing.
I came to the Bronx. I mean, my first stint in the Bronx was I went to Fordham. I lived on campus.
Right.
And then I went back to Brooklyn.
Right.
And And then I lived in Brooklyn for some time before Brooklyn was hipster.
Right.
And yeah. I went back to Sunset Park. I lived in Bay Ridge. Then I lived in Washington Heights.
Mm-hmm.
And, Washington Heights, you know, it was okay, but I mucha bulla. You know, it was just, I just kind of needed
more quiet.
Just a little bit of quiet.
So you consider yourself like a true, you are a New Yorker.
I am.
Do you feel fortunate and free?
Huh. I feel, yeah, that's a great question. I feel super privileged, I have to tell you. I'm in awe sometimes of the, you know, if I was religious, I would say the blessings, mm-hmm. but, you know, I'm not really. That I have, I get to travel all over the country to talk to people doing amazing work, right? I get to sit around and talk about race, ethnicity, and gender, and all day, right? Think about how I'm going to give money. I get to give money away, like, give me a break, right? I get to make decisions like, right? Like, how am I going to fund the groups that are working with Black Lives Matter? Like, what privilege, right? And my voice, I get to write blogs, yeah, about these kinds of things. I get to have these types of conversations. And I think when I was a little girl, I wouldn't have known what this was, but it would never have crossed my mind. And so I feel, you know, I feel super privileged, and I don't take that lightly. You know, I really, really try to stay grounded in why it's important, right, to do work like this. When you see, right, the young brothers that were killed last week,
mm-hmm.
that's why. And so I think it's, but then I also feel like, yeah, but I have an office on Madison Avenue, right? So it's sort of like this sort of bizarre,
highbrow, lowbrow.
Yeah, you know, and
lifestyle.
And how do you, somebody was making fun of me the other day because I have, I can be very, I fly so much, right? I can be very, particular about my flying, right? Like, I don't like to sit in middle seats if I'm going across the country. And my friend was like, pues nena, look at who you've become. And I thought to myself, yeah, you know, I'm a little bougie when it comes to like flying across the country. I'm going to
you have a lot of responsibility.
Yeah,
you have to fly.
I'm like
comfortable.
I'm
game with that.
Yeah.
I understand.
I totally, you know, I felt really funny, like defending it a little bit. Like, you're in a plane for 6 hours, you know, you have
posture.
Yeah, it matters.
Totally.
You know, you're working while you're on the plane. It's not like you're just watching movies. So, So I feel fortunate. Very fortunate and quite free, actually. Yeah, it's a great, I like that question. I might steal it from you.
Who knows? I mean, it could be, and the question, you can answer it as in mm-hmm. extraterrestrial life will come to Earth. They will make contact. I don't know, something like that.
I so wish, so I'm a big Star Trek fan, so, mm-hmm. you know, in my ideal world, mm-hmm. right, there's, the Vulcans are looking down at us, waiting for us to be ready for first contact.
Shit, man.
They're good. They're our friends. You know, I would not have thought myself be an optimist, right? Some years ago, but I do. I think we're in the right in the middle of fascinating change, right? And in a way that I think can be depending on which way we go, and I don't know that we'll see it in our lifetime, I think we could be, you know, in a world, if we came back 100 years from now, where, like, there'd be much more equity. You know, when I think about, I was having a conversation this past weekend, when we think about how much has changed, right, in the past 50 years, 40 years, we know people that were born when it was still on the books that a black man or could not marry a white woman, right? Like, we know people that were around then, or a woman could not get birth control without her husband's consent, right? Like, we know that wasn't that long ago. And so those of us that are in our 40s, right, we know folks, they're in our families, they're in our communities, that we work with them. Mm-hmm. And here we are, 2016, and, you know, there's all these awful things happening, and yet our gay and lesbian and transgender brothers and sisters can get married, right? Like, who would have thought? I didn't, you know, 15 years ago. And, you know, there's so much change happening. So I feel like sometimes when I think about, like, everything that's going on with sort of Trump and all of that, you know, craziness. Yeah. I feel like it's in response, definitely, to the economy. But I also think this is in response to, like, right, what has already started to happen, which is the black-brown majority.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't necessarily mean power, right? You can be, you can have a majority in numbers and then have economic or capital. But I think that, you know, when I think of all the madness that Trump goes around saying about the wall and the, you know, take the immigrants and all the horrible stuff, and I think, you know what, the problem with the analysis is that the black brown majority is already happening. Those babies have been born.
Right.
The people are here. Right. The women are, the black brown women are pregnant already, having more children. And that immigration actually right now to the United States from Mexico is at a net zero. Right. So I just feel like, you know, for me, there's something exciting about what the future can hold. But it will require an incredible amount of work, I think, on all of our parts, right? Because I don't think that just because we're going to be more in numbers means that we're going to have more power.
What's the optimist side saying?
To me, it's just there's something really...
You mean it's optimistic to see how the LGBTQ community can now marry. Definitely their, you know, their civil rights are advancing, you know, a mile a minute, whereas 10, 20 years ago it was unthinkable, versus or in contrast to what? What is so good about that, you think?
That's
the positive side of it. And then on the other side, there's some demagogy, like dangerous
right wing
fascist, right wing, reactionary, without a spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's,
you know, I think
two forces at play.
Yeah, and I also think that there's something about some of the youth movements that give me hope, you know, even Black Lives Matter. I mean, I think to me, you know, there's something really amazing and powerful about Black and brown people saying we love ourselves.
Yeah.
Right. We're standing up, not just because you're trying to kill us, but we're standing up because we say no more. We say our lives matter. We say, you should be held accountable, right? There's something to me that it's about me and you and young folks proclaiming, I love myself enough to risk my life and to risk my safety. And there's something powerful to me about that, that is important for us to, you know, when you see the reaction, like Blue Lives Matter, All Lives Matter, all of this stuff, people are reacting to the fact that brown and black people are saying, it's time for you to notice me. And I think there's something really important that we should not let slip by about this moment in time. I think there is danger, you know, that the powers that be have never, you know, just watching Games of Thrones, have never let power shift easily. And so that, I feel like that's what people are responding to.
Yeah.
People are responding to a way of life that they have no idea what's coming. And, you know, make America great again. I mean, we all know what that means. That means make America white again.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, I'm aware.
Yeah. Like, that's I'm not, aware. you know what they're trying to say there.
I'm aware.
And so I think there is danger. And so it's super important, I think, for Black and Brown coalitions to power building and for people to not get it twisted, right? That the danger is real.
Yeah.
But, and yet, I feel hopeful.
Okay. Yeah. You make me feel a little better. Mm. But I'm with you. I'm for the brown and black coalition.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I know. But there's work to be done.
We're Caribbean Afro princesses.
Queens. Hey. Somebody got to claim it, right?
Somebody does. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you. This is great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Follow Notes from a Native Daughter on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.